This is a podcast from RTE Radio 1.
Hello, you're very welcome to the 11th Hour with me, Vincent Woods. Tonight, a wide net, hopefully catching some things of interest for the weekend. Alistair MacLeod, would you take us back to what seems to be at the root of so much of your work, your childhood and youth on Cape Breton in Nova Scotia? What was that world like?
I grew up in Cape Breton Island in an essentially rural area, and we were on a farm, and we were close to a coal mining town, so some of us lived on the farm and some of us worked in the coal mines. This was an area settled largely by Gaelic-speaking people from the Western Highlands and the Islands, and they went there. Some of them, my paternal ancestors, in 1791, which was the time of the French Revolution. So that group was a group that consisted of pre-clearance people. Later, clearance people came, and the last group came in about 1830. So what was interesting, I think, about this group of people is that they kind of left, the edge of Europe and landed on the edge of North America. And they landed in a rural area, and there was nobody else to melt with or meld with. So they were essentially Gaelic-speaking people up until about the Second World War. So that made them different, I think, than other immigrants. You know, if you immigrate to a big city, you have to speak the dominant language really soon. But these people were kind of left alone for a long time. And the other thing that I find kind of interesting about them is for about three or four generations, they never worked for bosses. They never worked for what black people in America called the man, you know. So if you don't work for the man, you don't really need watches and you don't really need to be on time. You just work for yourself and you farm and you fish and you do that type of thing. When the coal mines came, then everybody had to work for the man, or the people who did work in coal mines worked for the man. And that meant that the males in the family had to learn English because that was the language of the employers. Women did not have to learn language as rapidly because you could run a home in Gaelic as well as you could in English.
Your father and many of your uncles worked in the coal mines.
Yes. My grandfather, when he was a boy, was putting hay in the cow's manger, and the cow raised her head and a horn pierced his eye, and he never got any medical attention, so he only had one eye. He was a big, strong man, but when he went to work in the coal mines, he couldn't pass the medical to get underground because he only had one eye. So I think he was kind of grumpy about that because he felt as denied of his chance to make $1 a day. I think
a lucky escape, in
yes.
a sense.
But his sons nearly all went to work in the mine. They had both eyes to begin with, although another lost his eye in the mine, and another, broke his leg, and another lost his hand. So maybe they weren't as lucky as their father what happened to them in a vocational manner.
How important were stories and storytelling in the world in which you grew up? Were stories handed down to you?
Well, I think we were, to a large extent, an oral culture. And if a lot of people didn't read English, a lot of people spoke and told Gaelic stories and were interested in that type of thing. And it's hard to know how much of that has an effect upon the individual. I can't sort of pinpoint a moment when I said, oh boy, I'm going to be a storyteller or anything like that. But I like to think of myself as a sort of oral storyteller. So I write a lot in the first person, because storytelling is older than literacy. And so I like to kind of have this conceit, I'm going to tell you a story now for 360 pages. And I know it's false, but I like the kind of intensity of the first person.
Was there that tradition in the family of storytelling as distinct from writing down the stories?
Well, I think, as I said, you know, we used to go to houses and there'd be people there telling stories. Some of them were old stories that came from Scotland, maybe. But others were just stories that were made up. And I think that one of the things you learned from being around people like that was the story had to be interesting or people just go away and, you know, wash their hair or something. So unless you had something to say that was interesting, you wouldn't be a very good short story teller.
They weren't going to listen.
No, yeah. So say, well, we're not going to his house because his stories are no good, you know. So, but when so-and-so tells a story, we'll go.
What drew you to writing as a means of expression?
Well, I studied for a PhD in literature at one time. And when you study for a PhD in literature, you sure learn a lot about literature. And I think I was in the United States for 6 years. And I think when you look at your future as a PhD student in literature, it seems you're going to spend a lot of your time, you know, writing articles on other people's literature, you know, imagery in James Joyce's The Dead and so on, you know. So although I appreciated that, I think I said, well, instead of just spending a life writing articles on other people's stories, why don't I write my own stories? And I think because I was in the United States and away from my home landscape, shall we say, I became more thoughtful about it. So I said, well, if I'm going to tell stories, you know, I'll have to set them someplace, and why not set them in the place that means the most to me? Because this, it seemed to me, was what most good writers, you know, had done.
There's this sense in reading your work of an entire world. It's as if, in some ways, place, nature, and people become one. The people become unified within the place, and maybe that is what a full world is. Did you consciously set out to achieve that?
Perhaps so. I'm interested in geography, and I think that people who live in certain geographies have certain worries that people who live in other geographies do not have. So I think that if you live near the ocean, you're worried about the ocean, you're worried about the tides, and you're worried about the fishing industry, and you're worried about your boat, and you're worried if you're going to catch any fish and so on. And so your worries are different than somebody who lives in the middle of the prairies or something like that. And I think because I grew up essentially on an island, that people who live on islands and have been there for a long time are kind of intensified, you know. So the other thing is, I think if you grow up as a child, you have sort of foisted upon you the kind of worries of your parents, you know, like later when you're 17 or 19 or 16, you can leave that world behind. But I think when you're 5 or when you're 6 or something like that, you know, you eat the food that your parents put before you, and you share their concerns. So if they're always listening for the wind or something like that, then you grow up listening to the wind. And I think, you know, Canada's a big, big country, like 4,700 miles wide, and people in different regions have different worries and different concerns. So I think that I have maybe a group of people here who are, you know, kind of shaped by the natural world in which they live.
That kind of strong woman is quite central to your work, and a tension between men and women. John McGarren said that your work it's a very masculine world, and yet also there are these incredibly strong women. Sometimes it seems stronger than the men, unsentimental. They must survive.
Yes, well, some people see the women as hard-hearted and, not very lovey-dovey and so on. And other people see the women, as you describe them, as strong, and they see the men as kind of dreamy and so on. But I think what was happening at that time, and it still happens today to a certain extent, in a lot of homes, men go away to work, you know. They go far away, and they leave behind families. And in the absence of the men, the women have probably more than their share of, you know, child-rearing responsibilities and so on. And the men go away and they send home money and then they come back and they have money and so on. But it's a certain kind of society, and it has been for a long time. The other thing, I think, is that nearly all of the men's work occurs outside the home, you know. So these men, if they're farmers or if they're fishermen or if they're loggers or if they're miners, if they wouldn't be away for a long time, you know, in terms of weeks or months or something, they would get up early in the morning and go and do whatever they had to do, and they would come home in the evening. And in the meantime, the women would be, you know, running the home and looking after the children. So there is kind of a division of labor, because the physical work the men do is so physical and demands, like, strong people physically, there is a division of labor, so that women do not work in coal mines, you know, or in logging camps. So there's that division. It's not like being an accountant or something like that, sure. You know, where your gender doesn't matter.
Again, there's a sense in with the men of an aloneness, of almost a kind of lost quality. I mean, they're sometimes physically maimed by the work they do, but there's also this sense of almost an emotional maiming through circumstance, and perhaps also through life and loneliness.
Yes, well, I think because of the work they do, they're often in the company of other men for long periods of time. And I think of them sometimes, you know, like sort of football teams or something like that. You know, these are big, strong men, and they're dependent on one another. And, you know, their life is the life of the body. And if the body fails them, as it eventually will, they're sometimes bereft, or sometimes their careers, such as they are ended. The people who work in the shafts work away from almost everybody else except themselves. The Scottish writer Andrew Grieg once said that mountain climbers are like athletes without fans, like nobody sees what they do up there above the clouds. And I think these men are kind of like that, the other extreme. If they're not up above the clouds, they're deep down beneath the earth. You
know? And deep within themselves.
Within
too.
Themselves.
Music, song and poetry run strongly through your work. A great deal of it Scots Gaelic. Indeed, some of the stories seem almost like some of the great ballads. But how important has that been to you, music and song? Is it from your upbringing?
I think it is. And I think that a lot of these songs are like work songs, you know. And I think songs were sort of used by a lot of people to you know, make work go by faster or easier. And one thinks of, you know, sea shanties where people sang in choruses as they pulled on ropes, or the songs sung by former slaves on a plantation, you know, or, you know, and those kind of songs were pleasurable, I think, in the face of repetitious and tedious work. But there are other songs, you know, love songs and songs which are beautiful and, you know, which would be sung by individuals rather than previous songs that I mentioned, which are kind of like heave-ho songs, you know.
There's a marvelous detail in one of the stories where an old man who's one of the great singers is asked to go with some of his family to sing in a big televised production. And he doesn't want to shorten the songs. They want him to abbreviate them. He doesn't want to do it.
Well, that was kind of an interesting issue, because a lot of these songs were really long. You know, they'd be 20 minutes long or something. And then when radio came in, a lot of people said, oh, you know, songs are supposed to be 3 minutes long. We have this all wrong, you know. You used to get points for long songs, and now you get demerits, you know.
It's great when the producer says to him, that's enough after 2 or 3 minutes. He says, but it's a narrative.
Yes,
well, want to keep singing.
Yes, he wants to keep singing. And the other thing is, because they're Gaelic singers, and the audience was kind of, in this case, kind of diminishing. You know, the one group says, well, you know, we'll just sing nonsense songs. You know, there's a song that they end up singing called Brachenlohm. And Brachenlohm, the message in Brachenlohm is thin soup, thin soup, thin, thin, thin soup, you know, which is certainly not a narrative. But the person who advocates this song says, well, nobody knows the difference anyway. You know, like we're just singing, you know, it's like singing E-I-E-I-O all evening, you know. But for some, of course, the songs do mean something. And if you spent your life perfecting these songs, you don't want to be up there singing nonsense syllables, nor do you appreciate other people reducing your language to nonsense syllables just because they don't care.
Mm. So it's very much about language as personal identity, isn't it? I mean, some of the men in the stories actually find themselves returning to Gaelic as they get older. And they're almost unaware of the fact that they've absorbed the language so much when they were children.
I think that in the case of the miners, if you work in a mine for a long time, you're hammering steel into rock. And what happened to a lot of these men is that they become deaf. And deaf people like to be around people that they're familiar with because they can kind of read their lips and they kind of know what the other people are saying, if not what they're thinking. So this, I think, in my view, makes them more kind of dependent on one another because we're all comfortable with people who understand us, so you don't have to be saying, what, all the time? Sorry, you know. You can just more or less relax with people who are like yourself. And if you grew up speaking Gaelic and if English was kind of grafted onto you, you perhaps return to the original language, which was perhaps the language of your heart.
Is there a sense in which your work is both celebration and lamentation? You're capturing a world and yet you're also marking what seems to be the end of that world.
I'm describing a world and, you know, I think when you describe any world, there's kind of good news and bad news in all worlds and in all lives. And the American writer, the late American writer Raymond Carver said, it is the job of the writer to bring the news, you know. So this is the kind of news that I bring, and it's not all good news and it's not all bad news, but I think that's the way that that all lives probably are.
Mm, it's certainly news of change, isn't it? I mean, especially in the later stories where you see, for instance, the German tourists coming in who want to buy up the land. There are old people left in farms which are falling apart, and you realize that this cannot sustain.
Yes, and I think, you know, people who lived by themselves perhaps didn't always value the land because it was just there. And you know, there are cases where old men sold, you know, seafront property for, you know, $5,000, and then you see the same property in the New York Times for $300,000, you know. Too bad he didn't know that his property was worth $300,000. Or now, in the eyes of these people's grandchildren, you know, why didn't he keep the land for us? But, you know, at the time, it wasn't so easy. So I think that whole land question is, you know, it's interesting, you know, where land was seen as, you know, almost a hindrance, you know, at one time. Or life on the land was seen as inferior to life in the cities. And then this land now, you know, may be valued as holiday properties or something like that, you know, where there are no cows and there are no sheep and people are no longer living off the land, but some are living on the land, and there is a difference.
But I suppose here in your work, and this is what makes it remarkable, the people continue to live. We can see their lives. We can see the life that you saw, but then we can see past it to the stories that came down and the people who shaped that landscape.
Well, that's very, very kind of you to say that. I mean, this is what I try to do. One is, I think as a writer, one is, you know, sort of sending out messages in bottles or something. You're not quite sure whether the messages land in the anywhere, you know, but that is essentially what I'm trying to do.
Alistair MacLeod, thank you very much indeed for talking to us.
Thank you.
In a new exhibition at the Mermaid Arts Centre in Bray, County Wicklow, Mary Kelly has used her photographs of the graffiti in building site toilets, often crude and expletive-ridden, turning them into eight large floor-to-ceiling pillars, contrasting starkly with the language on the other side of the hoardings, the aspirational and glamorous marketing speak. On these eight pillars, she's also returned to the origins of building by overlaying them with sketches of Roman columns to create something which she hopes represents the new Ireland we see around us. Elizabeth O'Neill went along to the Mermaid Arts Centre and asked Mary Kelly exactly why she's so interested in buildings.
Pillars feature largely in my work. There are eight pillars here, two lines of pillars in this room, taking up most of the space as we look down through. The reason I used the term pillars was because everybody knows that pillars are the sort of basis, they are the things that prop things up. They are the, if you like, the pillars of society. The Vitruvian pillars were the orders of architecture that the Roman engineer Vitruvius used 200 years before Christ. And they became, if you like, the mainstay of architecture for hundreds of years. The orders of architecture were based on the pillars. You know, everybody knows the Doric, the Ionian and the Corinthian columns. And the reason they were so important was because, I suppose, they are such a fundamental part of why a building or how a building stands up. Now, I was looking in pillars for the essence, if you like, of the whole building process. I went into a lot of building sites over the past 3 years and around the outsides as well of building sites, and I was looking at what, you know, this force that sort of gets, it's obviously it's very physical, to make something work, to build something, there's a huge amount of force and effort. It's a very tough business, and I wanted to look at some of the essence behind that building process. For example, in this space, and these pillars were made specifically for the space because they're 50 centimetres across and they go from the floor to the ceiling, and I wanted them to look like part of the architecture of the room here, because they stand for, if you like, something that underlies the whole building process even today. I have tons, hundreds of photographs which I took which show other aspects of the building process, because it was the process I was interested in. I've tons of videos of other parts of the process. It was by the way that I came across the graffiti in the toilets, and then I would notice it in some of the other places that I went to. And then, for example, you'll see in that image I have over there, the photographic image, which is actually an on-site. It's an image on the wall. It's on-site, and it happens to be a pillar, and there's graffiti on the pillar, because the graffiti does extend outside the toilets as well, but it's particularly dense in the toilets. The Vitruvian order was very much to do with proportion and decorum and measurement, and very often the measurement of the particularly the human body and the head in particular. And it's such an opposite, if you like, to the language. Like, for example, here we have Jenny, let me lick your bullet hole and then come all over you and then lick it again. So you see this sort of sexualized posturing. Things are tried out in this sort of private space that are sort of a fantasy situation, and it has a certain energy. It can be quite shocking sometimes because it's unmediated. In other words, it's not part of normal social discourse. When I was photographing the toilets, I literally opened the door and shot. I didn't stop to see what I was shooting because I felt that would be the best way to represent the images. And then when I decided to choose eight photographic images to enlarge onto the pillars, I did it in the same way. I took the first eight images that came to me to hand. because otherwise I didn't want to edit the actual imagery that was going to go on to the pillars, because then it starts becoming something else. Mm. On this pillar, we have an oversized, if you like, aspect to the door of the particular toilet. You have the sort of a fairly industrial lock and handle, and they're sort of oversized. And it gives the pillar a sort of sculptural, if you like, strange aspect to the actual door of the toilet, of course, with the usual graffiti and the little wadding of paper stuck in the keyhole lock. In fact, it highlights the privacy of the space and the privacy of the act, if you like, of what's going on and therefore what comes from that space. I was particularly struck by, whenever I worked on sites, I was particularly struck by the force. The language, in fact, that's used between the men themselves is a language that they may not necessarily use outside of their workplace. And there's a lot of posturing, there's a lot of, maybe it's because of the toughness of the job or just the sheer mass force of a male energy. But it certainly has its own dynamic.
So aside from the eight pillars in the exhibition, you also have some photographic work hanging on the walls. So can you describe that work to me?
Yeah, well, the photographic work is the other side, if you like, of this dialogue between the pillars and the hoarding on the outside of building sites. And I find the hoarding fascinating because it's this other type of language that's completely different. It's the upstage language, the outside, the hopes and dreams and aspirations and advertising and marketing speak, if you like. And it is in such contrast to the language on the inside of the building, at the very heart of the building. And for that reason, I made these into photographic images, because that is part of the advertising way of looking at things. They're very beautiful, they're very sleek, and they're very clean in one way. But they have, for example, this particular image here, and it's called Image 1 because it's referring to images, is of a certain hoarding in Dublin. You can see the road in front and you can see the hoarding and you can see the text where. And I think most people in Dublin would have passed this particular advertisement before the buildings actually started to come up. And it's a man sort of fiddling with his cufflink. It's a very stereotypical image, but it tells us an awful lot about what we aspire to, or what we follow, or the ideals that we consume, if you like. I always come back to us, because it's if you like, what I'm doing is re-imaging back out those things that I notice that are part of our world and reflect it back. And for example, this image makes me think about how, and I think most of us, even though we're immune to some degree to advertising, but we're hugely caught up in it too. And what does it say about us as a society? What are our ideals and our aspirations? You know, is it a sense of wanting to be exclusive and better than and perfect, etc.?
Artist Mary Kelly there talking about her exhibition Pillars 1, which is running at the Mermaid Arts Centre in Bray, County Wicklow, until May the 26th. And Mary will be giving a public talk at the gallery on Saturday next, May the 19th, at 2 o'clock.
You've been listening to a podcast from RTE Radio 1. For more details of our podcasts, visit rte.ie/radio1.